It does not say who they are who are to defend the people's liberty. They are parliaments, magistrates of the people. Cromwell took part in a war already begun between king and parliament, was obedient to parliament in his role as military commander, and attempted for years to establish what might be called parliamentary government, ironically at last dismissing parliament and ruling alone, just as Charles I had done. In Geneva, there were governing councils in place long before the Savoyards were driven out, and before Calvin's arrival. They continued to govern. This kind of continuity must have seemed possible for some time in England as well. The worthies who signed the American Declaration of Independence and negotiated the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution were acting as representatives of the people and were generally accepted as such. After its revolution, France attempted parliamentary government and ended up with the Emperor Napoleon. Though this model has not been consistently successful, its successes have been sufficient to make it important to the emergence of the modern West. In this context, the Cromwell period is again no anomaly, and the Calvinist basis of its activism is not far to seek. The idea that there is liberty that inheres in the people, and that kings have no right to abuse, is consistent with interpretations of the Magna Carta that emerged under Edward VI and Somerset. It is important to remember that both the Magna Carta and Calvin's Institutes were translated under their patronage. The second of these might well have influenced the reading of the first, since in the Charter there is no comparably explicit assertion of what might be called the unalienable rights of the poor community over against the king. The claims of the Magna Carta are entirely of, by, and for the barons, whose appeal to custom had no positive implications for the people custom allowed them to despoil. What is lost in the fact that our early history is distorted by suppressions and omissions? I was surprised by the importance of women in the literary culture of the Renaissance, specifically Calvinist women, who patronized and protected writers and who themselves wrote poetry and drama and made translations. Lucy Hutchinson, the wife of a regicide, wrote an epic based on Genesis, and made the first complete translation into English of Lucretius's On the Nature of Things. Anne Vaughan Locke wrote the first sonnet cycle in English. Mary Sidney wrote tragedies, as well as the greater part of the verse translation of Psalms, begun by her brother Philip. I have come across the names of many more than I have had time to look into. The rise of English as a literary language would have been an encouragement to women, who were not often educated in the use of Latin. In any case, this period was clearly a stimulus to literary expression as well as to theological and other learning in women. When I write about the character and importance of Puritanism, it is not with the intention of suggesting that we could or should return to it. It was as much a long historical moment as it was a distinct tradition. It struggles with orthodoxy and the marked tendency of its own institutions to decry elements of orthodoxy were a consequence of the fact that orthodoxy was inconsistent with its own tenets. It was meant to be reformed and continuously reforming. The hardest definitions it made of itself were an effect of its defenses against the pressures of an environment in which non-conformity, as it was called, was subject to exclusion from civic life. The acts of uniformity imposed by Elizabeth and others, which were meant to enforce by fines weekly attendance at an Anglican church, together with exclusion from university, public office, property ownership, and so on, were the kind of thing that hardened the perimeters of any minority. These strategies of self-defense tend to become identifying features of the group, from the point of view of members as well as outsiders, no matter how arbitrary they are in their origins. Protestant men from certain regions of Europe, especially clergy, still wear beards beneath their chins because the soldiers who once harassed them wore mustaches. To doff their hats or not, to stand or kneel or not, were choices that were meaningful in highly particular settings and signs of their participation in particular controversies. Once in America, without the context that made them meaningful, these customs began to seem anomalous over time, and provincial. In the early 19th century, Harvard became Unitarian, while Yale adhered to its ancestral Congregationalism. Amherst and Andover were founded to shore up the old religion, which changed under their influence in ways that would seem unexpected, given the assumptions we would be likely to bring to the idea of a restored Puritanism. These two schools, with Yale, became the front line of the abolitionist movement. They helped found and staff other new colleges in the disputed territories of the Midwest, which in turn became outposts of abolitionism. Higher education, liberal education, became a very important medium for the advancement of radical social reforms. The movement that scattered these colleges over the landscape, a very distinctive feature of American civilization, has had immeasurable consequences, including its contributions to the ultimate elimination of slavery. Since my interest here is in putting both American Puritanism and certain writers in context, I will consider for a moment the family of Emily Dickinson, citizens of Amherst. Dickinson's grandfather was among those who felt passionately that the loss of Harvard to Unitarianism had to be compensated by the creation of a new school to train congregational clergy. He poured so many of his resources into the project that he went bankrupt and had to go west to recoup his losses. Where did he go? To Lane Theological Seminary in Cincinnati, Ohio, where he seems to have looked after the school's finances and invested in land. Lyman Beecher was the president of Lane, and Calvin Stowe taught there, the father and the husband, respectively, of Harriet Beecher Stowe, who lived in Cincinnati from the age of 21 to the age of 35. Lane was at the time the largest Protestant seminary in the country, and the Beechers, and increasingly the students as well, were involved with abolition and the Underground Railroad. This provided the material for Stowe's famous novel. Old Dickinson came home, and the college was opened. Amherst provided a low-cost education to aspiring clergy and opened its classes to auditors as well, townspeople and younger students like Dickinson herself. Congregational clergy were trained in the liberal arts before they began their theological training, so Amherst was a rich resource for its community. Dickinson briefly attended nearby Mount Holyoke College, a school meant to provide a low-cost education to young women from the poor hill towns around Amherst. The school was founded on what was called the manual labor system. Everyone at the school, student or faculty, contributed work to the running of the school. The president, Mary Lyon, baked the bread. This system was characteristic of colleges founded by the anti-slavery movement, for example, Knox College and Oberlin. It was meant to keep higher education affordable, to erase social inequality, and to create a more useful, educated class. It was directed against slavery in that it encouraged the individualism of self-sufficiency, as opposed to the habits of exploitation of others associated with slavery and social inequality. Mount Holyoke was one of a number of colleges or seminaries established in New England during this period. Women's higher education was part of a movement toward gender equality associated more broadly with anti-slavery. We tend to think of these female seminaries as sequestering, perhaps, but they in fact provided young women with a privilege unique in the world at the time, a rigorous education comparable to the education enjoyed by young men, and on terms that were intended to make them accessible, to remove financial barriers. All these schools have evolved into institutions of a very different kind, with a very different impact on society, and the genius of their early years and first intentions is by now a lost memory. They are worth considering not only because they help to interpret the vast development of the educational culture so characteristic of this country, but also, for my purposes, because they are the self-interpretation of the last population who identified, without irony or affectation, as Puritan. They were the most radical social reformers this country has ever seen, in part because they had an extraordinary opportunity to put the impress of their values on a civilization very much in a formative stage, in part because they felt, and they were right to feel, that the civilization was tending away from them. The Unitarianism of Harvard was seen even then as more sophisticated, if not more learned, than the old religion. I will observe, in earnest hopes of being corrected, that Harvard figures very little in this epic tale. I know of no college founded from Harvard in this period. Troops of young Yale Divinity School graduates went out into the wilderness to spread enlightenment in a true sense of the word among these new towns and populations. They left a heritage that, if it were known, might even give goodness a good name. The whole movement had a kind of heroic generosity in its design and intention that is rare in history, and it persisted through decades, planting colleges throughout the Midwest and in Colorado, California, and Hawaii. Josiah Lovejoy, a famous anti-slavery martyr in Illinois, was a Princeton man. I await information that will correct me. It appears from my reading that sophisticated Harvard did not exactly throw itself into this great work. So Emily Dickinson, in going to Mount Holyoke, was stepping into the stream of a reformist movement. We all know that she soon stepped out of it again. Why she chose to go home to her family, we will never know. There is a tendency to present her as captive to a rigid society, but the female seminary actually offered intellectual liberation not available to women in any other society of the period. Whatever her reasons, she did well, giving the world a body of work it would be much poorer without. In going home, it must be noted, she did not seclude herself from the distinctive radicalism of her time and community. She could hardly have done so, because the Dickinsons were very much involved in it, at least by association. Her brother, Austin, was a close friend of Frederick Law Olmsted, the great landscape designer and abolitionist. They wandered around the local woods together, finding native vegetation suitable for planting on the Amherst Green and the campus of the agricultural school that would become the University of Massachusetts. And Dickinson wrote to Thomas Wentworth Higginson, asking for his response to her poetry. Higginson, I hasten to note, was a graduate of Harvard Divinity School. He was not only a great abolitionist, the commander of a black regiment in the Civil War, a friend and supporter of John Brown, but also a strong proponent of women's rights and workers' rights before and after the war. Clearly she knew to whom she was writing. Higginson is himself a wonderful essayist, both brilliant and ingratiating. He traveled to Amherst to meet the poet who had written to him, and then wrote a singularly fine evocation of her. After Dickinson's death, her sister brought the trove of her poetry to him, and he edited and published it. This story is very often told in a way that makes a villain of Higginson. He is supposed to have made the wounding assessment of her work that discouraged her from publishing more than a scant few poems. Clearly, however, Higginson was a gifted man, strongly predisposed to reading a woman poet with great interest and respect. His report of his encounter with her certainly reflects this. If he tried to nudge her toward slight changes that would make her strange and difficult poetry a little more accessible to the general reader, this is surely a forgivable error in an editor responding to the work of someone so complex and elusive. My point is that everywhere Dickinson looked, there was radicalism of some kind, reform of some kind. Her reactions to it all, so far as I can tell, are undiscoverable. Clearly, however, the cliché of her being an intellectual captive in a frozen world is simply wrong. Perhaps her brother's long and open affair with Mabel Loomis Todd and the stoicism with which it seems to have been accepted is another light on the radicalism of the time and place. The ideal of Puritan reform was not essentially nostalgic, but was instead primitivist. It re-examined the most fundamental institutions, including social hierarchy, including, emphatically, marriage. It gave no presumptive positive significance to the fact that social relations of any kind were long-standing, or seemingly universal, and this included gender relations. This is true at the same time that marriage, as covenant, was, according to Calvin, the bond most favored by God. This vision of it is an aspect of the rejection by him and other reformers of priestly celibacy and of celibacy in general as a more sacred condition than marriage. The idealization of marriage changed the understanding of it in ways that might not have been foreseen. The first modern divorce was granted in Calvin's Geneva. In any case, I have omitted one great factor in all this, which is the Second Great Awakening. A few preachers, Charles Grandison Finney notable among them, set off a lengthy and again radical religious revival that swept the Northeast, especially upstate New York, the motherland of American religions. Finney was a lawyer and church musician who underwent a profound religious experience, trained as a minister, and became a revivalist, which at that time was a highly respectable calling, aspired to by learned men, a credential that qualified one for a college presidency, for example. The conversion experiences that drove this awakening and their consequences are best described by William James in The Varieties of Religious Experience. He was writing after the heat of the moment had passed, more or less, but describing to his Scottish audience the demonstrable transformative effects of these highly individual raptures that Americans were inclined to pass through. The conversion, as in Finney's case, was not a change of religious belief, but an intensification of it. This was hoped for and encouraged as a sign of one's acceptance by God. It was the experience of all but two of the students at Mount Holyoke, while Dickinson was there, one of the two being, of course, Dickinson. It is all rather hard to imagine now, but James's point, and a thing well worth noting, is that these most intense excitements, passing through whole populations, had consequences that were overwhelmingly benign. These excitements were too much for some to endure. Hospitals in affected regions were prepared to treat what they called religious hysteria. But there was no ramping up of old hostilities. No one was burned or hanged. Certain offshoots were trivial or absurd, of course, but a great part of these energies went into anti-slavery activity. Finney himself became a professor, then the president of the new Oberlin College, accepting the appointment on the condition that all races and both genders would be admitted on equal terms. The philanthropist behind the creation of Oberlin was no other than Lewis Tappan. He created it as a place where abolitionist students, expelled from Lane Theological Seminary for their radicalism, could complete their education and express their radicalism without inhibition, which they did. So, when these self-professed Puritans, who had effectively lost any place in England and knew they were losing ground in America, set out to renew their tradition, the effort was marked by intense piety, the founding of many schools intended to promote reform, and utopianism striking enough to earn a mention in Engels's essay on the viability of communist societies for both Brook Farm and Florence, Massachusetts. There is a tendency among historians to treat the efflorescence of Puritanism as a departure from it or a rejection of it, a pure consequence of the polemically negative characterization of Puritanism. In fact, all those schools, the reforms in the status of women, the conscious inculcation of a work ethic as a rejection of the association of status with leisure based on exploitation, were not changes that made us more like the rest of the world. In fact, they made us more like ourselves, and our better selves. All this brought on the Civil War. It could hardly do otherwise. Of course, it would be truer to say that slavery itself brought on the Civil War. Again, I am aware of exploring lost history. I mentioned how aware I am that I bear the stigma of living in Iowa and of teaching in a public university. This country grossly impoverishes itself with this condescending or contemptuous dismissal of vast reaches of its terrain and the multitudes who live and die there. I have been asked 100 times why I teach at Iowa by people sophisticated enough to know that in my field anywhere else on earth would be a step down. So perhaps I teach at a public school in the Midwest because I am an elitist. I have my own reasons for being glad that Iowa is in Iowa. I would never myself have discovered the region or its history, which is an epical part of our national history and which settled into my literary imagination as satisfyingly as the prairie instructed me in a new aesthetics. And I take comfort in the fact that the state has no death penalty, that there are earnest and ambitious efforts to educate people in prison. I am pleased that Iowa has one of the highest literacy rates in the country, and the 4th lowest rate per capita of gun ownership. If I were to use that profile to choose a better state to live in, I would be hard-pressed to find one. I am pleased that marriage equality was recognized early in Iowa, and that since it was a territory, Iowa has had no laws forbidding interracial marriage, and no laws permitting segregation in schools. If I were to add these to the profile, my choices would be narrower still, probably approaching zero. Every 4 years, the national media come to Iowa to photograph cows. Since I am a connoisseur of forgotten places, I have a house in upstate New York. I could demonstrate for the press the existence of many cows, just a cab ride and a train ride from Trump Tower. Speaking of which, or of whom, I don't appreciate being blamed by the New York Times for that phenomenon, that most New York phenomenon, a sort of political Paris Hilton, famous for being famous by virtue of their own fascinated attention. There's no point mentioning that Donald Trump didn't win Iowa, since Ted Cruz did. In any case, rumors persist that Cleveland has an orchestra and also a clinic. Chicago has some interesting architecture and a few decent universities. There's a museum in Kansas City whose ancient Near Eastern collection is more or less inexhaustible if you like that sort of thing. There are those for whom Ann Arbor is a synonym for paradise. I joke, of course. A region of 60 million people of every possible ethnicity, thickly strewn with colleges and universities, and with a long history of relative wealth, is no simple heartland, no backwater or cultural desert. If population density is productive of desirable traits, it has its great conurbations. I will mention, however, that Iowa City is larger than Periclean Athens. I am weary of omissions, of failures to acknowledge. People can be convinced that they live in a small country for all purposes, where there are few options and markers of success or failure that will be recognized anywhere. My reformers had a glorious sense of space and freedom, very deeply impressed by obligation. They made it, by human and historical standards, a great theater of heroic generosity, which, despite all, is sometimes palpable still. At this time, the country needs to regain equilibrium and direction. It needs to recover the memory of the best it has done, and then try to do it all better. Mind, conscience, soul. Plenary address at the Religious Affections in Colonial North America Conference, Huntington Library, San Marino, California, January 27, 2017. I am deeply indebted to Jonathan Edwards. Reading him in college, assigned portions of the great Christian doctrine of original sin defended, made me aware of a much more plausible ontology than anything compatible with the ugly determinisms on offer then and now in courses on philosophy and psychology. I could put a name to my discontents because I had an older brother who shared them, but I got past them finally one particular afternoon, reading from a 19th-century edition of Edwards's works. Everything about this assignment suggested drudgery, but that hour felt like an awakening, so to speak, as if a great burden had been lifted from my soul. I recognize the irony of my having been rescued by precisely this text. In it, Edwards describes being as emergent, and the continuities we depend on not as intrinsic, but as wholly sustained by God. So reality is indeterminate within a very broad and arbitrary frame of probabilities and possibilities until it happens. In other words, Edwards dismisses the narrow causal channel of conventional deterministic thinking, which is also essential to Freudianism, Skinnerism, Marxism, or Neo-Darwinism. His purpose is to defend the traditional doctrine that implicates all generations in the sin of Adam, without reference to individual transgression. He asserts another, higher-order determinism, which is the freedom of God, constrained only by his own nature. Very characteristic of recent theories about humankind is the assumption that we are the creatures of our race or genes or the traumas we have suffered or the shape of our brains. These theories have been put aside one after another as they are found to be based in errors of fact that yield errors of reasoning or vice versa. Edwards taught me how to understand that something much richer and stranger is going on than any of these schemes can begin to suggest. I realize I am involving myself in complicated thoughts about a treatise that is not my subject. My purpose is simply to say that I have long seen Edwards very differently than as the black-clad cleric with spiders on his mind. His conception of being as emergent opened Emerson, Dickinson, Melville, and Whitman to me, and William James as well. He helped me wonder constructively about what Puritanism actually was. He certainly made me wonder what I was looking at when I read his work and theirs. It seems the universe is a kind of foam, huge voids with filaments of conventional matter, galaxies, constellations, and so on, surrounding them like the skin on bubbles. These voids grow. They put enormous pressure on matter, pressure so great that the force of it is attributed in some part to dark energy, of which we know nothing. It, with these voids, may account for the accelerating expansion of the universe with consequences so profound that a human observer, however well-equipped, living 1 or 2 billion years from now, granting that there might be such a creature, would see nothing but void. I offer this as a metaphor for contemporary American intellectual life, which is also a thing of forceful and expanding voids, driven by a nameless energy that pushes reality out of shape and might ultimately push it out of sight altogether. I am not talking about popular culture or about the impact of new technologies. There is really nothing very new about the phenomenon I describe. If there is anything essentially American about it, this is probably true because we educate such a large part of our population. We educate them, or more properly, we condition them in a way that makes them averse to knowing all kinds of things. We teach them that they already know what it is essential to know, that certain things are worthy of unvarying and uninformed contempt. Many people are aware that Edwards wrote a sermon about hell and damnation. Many highly educated people are aware that Edwards is generally considered the finest philosophic mind this continent has produced. They all have the same fixed ideas about him and his America, learned from the same high school or college anthology, with the same excerpt from that sermon, which is offered as an epitome of New England thought and culture, though it is certainly not characteristic even of Edwards's writing, let alone his theological tradition. The void Puritanism has merged with the void Calvinism, swallowing Edwards along the way, to constitute a vast ignorance of early American history, a negative energy that obviates any awareness of contemporary British and European history, with which early New England history is so deeply intertwined. Specialists might think I overstate. But in my experience, specialists also are afflicted by the problems that come with this strange attrition, this general emptying out of whole fields of effective knowledge. America always has the great, interesting problem of arriving at some understanding of itself. History is entirely germane to this project. We have lived with norms and institutions we value. How did they develop? What have they meant to earlier generations? How have they been articulated and extended? The word conservative seems to have some authority among us, but how many of us know enough to be sure when our institutions are being defended and when they are actually under assault? We should have learned by now that the whole civilization could drift off its moorings amid much waving of flags, much loud talk of former greatness. Ideas about the nature of a good society were developed and applied in New England. They did not originate there. There were precursors on the continent and in England. For my purposes, it is enough to say that the Puritans were intent on a reformist experiment in New England, which was as much political as religious. The southern colonies, by contrast, were socially dominated by the Church of England, the capstone of royalist conservatism. When the Parliamentary Revolution, also called the Puritan Revolution, took place in England, many New Englanders crossed over to fight for Oliver Cromwell. There were perhaps 10 years when Puritans actually governed a commonwealth in England, a prosperous nation by its own recent standards, and despite the turmoil that typically follows revolution. Cromwell died, and his son quickly failed as his successor. The British call this period the interregnum, a word that marks an absence almost as complete for them as it is for us. The void that has swallowed early American history has swallowed this crucial passage in Anglo-American history. British historians typically say that Puritanism ended in 1689, at the time of the bloodless or glorious revolution, which might as well be called the unresisted invasion of England by William of Orange and a sizable army. This must mean that Puritanism ceased to be a threat to the established order in Britain, therefore that it is understood as primarily a political movement. It continued to flourish in America well into the 19th century, depending on definitions, and is still dominant among us, according to foreign observers, in those diminishing instances in which they think we are being overly fastidious about something. In any case, the writers Edwards cites and quotes at length in A Treatise Concerning Religious Affections are almost all Puritans of that old Cromwellian generation, active about a century before Edwards. All those I will quote from are from this period, my point being that in this treatise, Edwards is making a defense of a stable, elaborated tradition, not merely engaging in controversy. If there is a question in anyone's mind whether Edwards, writing in the mid-18th century, is himself a Puritan, his choice of references makes his own identification with them very clear. He does not quote to argue from authority, rather from affinity. He uses them to identify a core Puritanism over against religious excitements he and they denounced as hypocrisy. The work of the many Puritan writers who flourished in the Cromwell period was, even at the time, recognized as a striking element in the life of the movement and the culture. The British Puritan William Greenhill, in a preface to The Sincere Convert by Thomas Shepard, the Anglo-American founder of Harvard, says, "Did ever any speak since Christ and his apostles as men now speak? We may truly and safely say of our divines and writers, the voice of God and not of man, such abundance of the Spirit hath God poured into some men, that it is not they, but the Spirit of the Father that speaks in them. What infinite cause hath this age to acknowledge the unspeakable mercy of God in affording us such plenty of spiritual tractates, full of divine, necessary, and conscience-searching truths, yea, precious soul-comforting and soul-improving truths. In good books you have men's labor and God's truth." At the time of the Restoration, Roger L'Estrange, the royal government licenser of the press, laid out his plan for suppressing insurrectionist writings by radically limiting the number of presses, destroying condemned books, and severely punishing anyone who owned them or had any part in distributing them. He recognized that many printers would go out of business because the books he would be suppressing were the books people wanted to buy. It would be the most efficient, he said, to eliminate writers, since there were few of them in any generation. But John Milton and Andrew Marvell are noted Cromwellians, better understood in the context of their remarkably prolific generation. Shakespeare was the older contemporary of writers such as Richard Sibbes and William Ames, and he is fascinated by subjects that fascinated them, for example, the potency of conscience. The American historian Perry Miller has said the Puritans abhorred freedom of conscience on grounds he does not divulge. Glib as he is, thin as his scholarship is, I appreciate him as a nameable misfortune. In any case, it is remarkable how cleanly the Reformation has been severed from the English Renaissance, and how little attention is paid to the popular audience that writers and playwrights enjoyed in this period. It is simply annoying to have studied the period off and on for decades without ever seeing a reference to these important figures. The political character of Puritanism as part of an international movement is easily demonstrated. Many dissenters had gone to centers of reform learning in Geneva, Strasbourg, Wittenberg, and elsewhere. Hugh Peter, born and educated in England, served as a pastor in England, then in Rotterdam among the English there, then from 1635 as a pastor in Salem, Massachusetts. He returned to England seeking financial support for the colony and became involved in the incipient revolution as a chaplain, soldier, and close associate of Cromwell. In 1651, during the Puritan ascent, he published in London a little book titled Good Work for a Good Magistrate, or A Shortcut to Great Quiet. It is a small compendium of proposed reform, too interesting to be dealt with more than briefly here. It states that none can be free of great injustice who by persecution for religion take away liberty of conscience. It is to be noted that under Cromwell no one was prosecuted for his or her religion. The little book includes provisions liberal by modern standards, that doctors and lawyers should be paid at a fixed rate from the public treasury, for example. On the subject of crime, it says, "Let no malefactors against the light of nature and civil society escape punishment, but be justly and speedily punished, not in prisons beforehand, by cold, heat, stink, famine, or any other way, but out of humanity let them be comfortably provided for till sentence be given, and then let justice take place. That all murderers, thieves, whoremongers, adulterers, false witnesses, evil speakers, deceivers, bankrupts, drunkards, traitors, blasphemers, and all manner of evildoers may be duly punished, rather inclining to mercy than cruelty, and always with a merciful heart." I am sure we moderns do not meet this standard. In one respect, Peter is definitely harsher than we are. He proposes that they who, under pretense of able men, under color of merchandise, get other men's goods into their hands, and yet when they need not, bankrupt themselves on purpose to deceive others and enrich themselves, be sorely punished as very great thieves. Further, that no bankrupt may ever after come into any office or bear any rule in church or state. He says, "One bankrupt doth more hurt than 20 thieves that are put to death or sorely punished for it." I have quite recently acquired a context that allows me to understand what is referred to here. In any case, the only early legal system I have seen that is comparable to this one for gentleness and moderation is the code titled The Laws and Liberties of Massachusetts, promulgated 3 years earlier in 1648. This code remained the basis of Massachusetts law until our Revolution. In form and content, it anticipates the American Bill of Rights. In both cases, Cromwell and Parliament were dominant in England, and the social thought behind the laws was Puritan. Compare Dale's Laws, a body of laws imposed in Virginia in 1611, with its many death penalties for minor theft, for speaking ill of the English governors of the place, for running off to the Indians, and on the third offense, for skipping church. This horrible code was to be read in church on every Sabbath. Or compare the fundamental constitutions of Carolina, approved by the British governors of the territories of the South, from Virginia to Florida. This design was promulgated in 1669, after the Cromwell era and outside the sphere of Puritanism. It was meant to establish a fixed, hierarchical, land-based aristocracy, a virtual feudalism. Whether these laws were practical or sustainable, and the degree to which they ever took effect, are complex questions. It must be said, there is little evidence that the dominant Anglican elements in the South took exception to the notion of land-based aristocracy, a model with which they were entirely familiar. In other words, the reformist tendencies that lie behind American achievements in the direction of democracy and, John Winthrop's term of course, liberalism, have Puritanism in New England as fons et origo. Someone should write a good book about all this, one that would make distinctions historians seem never to make, between Puritan North and Anglican South, between the period of Cromwell on the one hand and the rest of the colonial period on the other, that is, between times when the colonies were necessarily self-governing and when they were compelled to renew their royal charters, and more generally, when the laws in force in any case were British and when they were colonial. Historians described the harsh legal practices of Virginia as colonial when in fact they were simply British. At the time of the Restoration, Peter, condemned in London as a traitor, was made to watch and the next day to suffer an execution so appalling I can't bring myself to describe it. It was cruel, yes, but it was not as unusual as one might wish, since Elizabeth the Great had introduced it as a punishment for recusant Catholics. Ah, well. In any case, Winthrop's sons were active in the English Revolution. Cromwell had once considered moving to Connecticut. Books like the ones Edwards quotes from were widely known on both sides of the Atlantic. Ties between England and Puritan North America were many and strong. One question. Were there no witch trials in the colonial South? They went on in Britain well into the 18th century. So in terms of social and religious culture, there is no reason I know of to exclude the possibility. The South itself has not appeared immune to outbursts of public violence. I mention this because the trials in New England, a strange departure from custom, have been treated as uniquely Puritan. With the generally lurid exploitations of the phenomenon, they add an aversive energy to the void of unknowing that has engulfed this interesting civilization. And one comment. Thank God for the publishers, whoever they are, who keep this once famous, enormously influential literature in print, in blurry facsimiles at best, though sadly enough sometimes abridged and modernized. The Reformation was all about the power of books. In this case, books that were once suppressed by law, even burned, are very nearly suppressed by the curious compounding of ignorance and aversion that is so important to our sense of our own history. It is appropriate and remarkable and melancholy that their continued life is owed to the fidelity of these printers of books, the descendants, perhaps, of the unacknowledged heroes of the Reformation and of the Renaissance as a whole. The writers Edwards cites were exploring the human psyche, individual human nature in its capacities as moral agent, in Edwards's terms, and as soul. Their vision of humankind was directly related to their thinking about the kind of political society that would be suited to its flourishing. It is a given of their thought that the soul can be and is meant to be ravished and transformed by an experience, something more than an insight or a vision, of the divine. While it is a given also that an experience of this kind is purely a gift of divine grace, they were intent on predisposing in one another and themselves a receptivity to this divine and supernatural light, which Edwards, with great subtlety, finally distinguishes from light, making it utterly different in kind from even this most rarefied earthly thing. He escapes the constraints of particularity his analogy might otherwise imply, and establishes a sense of the singularity of the high order of perception for which the senses barely supply analogies. The soul was made ready for this experience by the conscience, a human faculty the English Puritan John Flavel says is inferior only to God. Conscience lays bare the sinfulness and unworthiness that make clear the absolute dependency of any soul on God's grace. Those who pass through this experience and are changed by it are presumably true saints. Those who are part of the church and make a good account of themselves while awaiting the experience are also called saints or godly persons. We are familiar with a superficially similar version of this set of beliefs, and Edwards was too. The difference might be said to be one of emphasis, though it is in fact a profound difference. For Edwards, the authenticity of the experience is proved to the converted themselves in the right conduct of life. For those he criticizes, the experience itself is assurance of salvation without reference to conduct of life. In Some Thoughts Concerning the Present Revival of Religion in New England, Edwards describes at length what he calls the degenerating of these experiences, with which we are familiar as well. In All Things for Good, Thomas Watson says, Christians must keep a decorum, they must observe what is comely, and take heed of a morose, supercilious behavior. Religion does not take away civility, but refines it. In his Works, Edwards says, at length the experience of some persons, who began well, come to little else but violent motions of carnal affections, with great heats of the imagination, a great degree of enthusiasm, and swelling of spiritual pride. The unhappy subject of such a degeneracy, for the most part, is not sensible of his own calamity, but because he finds himself still violently moved, has greater heats of zeal, and more vehement motions of his animal spirits, thinks himself fuller of the Spirit of God than ever. Edwards considers this embarrassing. Persons will find themselves under a kind of necessity of making a great ado, with less and less affection of soul, till at length almost any slight emotion will set them going, and they will be more and more violent and boisterous, and will grow louder and louder, till their actions and behavior become indeed very absurd. He says zeal may degenerate more and more into human and proud passion, and may come to bitterness, and even a degree of hatred. It is in this declined form that unsympathetic history sees the whole tradition of what Edwards calls experimental, that is, experiential, religion. What history ignores is the extraordinarily fine-grained and humane attentiveness to perception and experience that follows from the high Puritan conception of the soul, we must grant them the word, as suited to the reception of ultimate truth and ultimate beauty. Their emphasis is suggested by the titles of their books, The Tender Heart, The Bruised Reed, The Art of Divine Contentment, A Treatise of the Soul of Man, Conscience with the Power and Cases Thereof. The great old writers of Edwards's tradition placed a most sacred and delicate mystery at the center of human inwardness. Perhaps this fact and its consequences elude us now, because our approach to the study of the psyche could hardly be more different from theirs. In fact, it can no longer be assumed that the words psyche or soul or mind can be taken to correspond to anything real. Whether this matters, putting aside the fact that either of these conceptions, theirs or ours, is of a kind to be judged broadly true or broadly false, depends on the importance a value-laden vision of human nature has in sustaining a democratic society, even a humane society. In any case, this is an important instance of the fact that these voids I have mentioned produce a sort of warping of perception that makes things the opposite of themselves. It would be impossible, in an environment without distortion, to make the case that Puritanism was harsh or cold or rigid. Nothing I have read forbids my taking Edwards to be pre-revolutionary, that is, to be feeling the tremors before the great upheaval he did not live to see. It came abruptly enough when it came to suggest that there were signs of imminent rebellion building for years, perhaps for 100 years. There had been Puritan religious excitements before and throughout the Cromwell period, and Edwards might have believed the Great Awakening to be what it was, in fact, the precursor of another revolution. Considering that New England was a population largely made up of near descendants of sympathizers with and collaborators in the first modern revolution, greatly augmented by refugees from the oppression that followed its collapse, considering that they had maintained the religious and intellectual culture of the revolutionaries, including extraordinarily high levels of literacy and an active press, considering that the population had grown so prodigiously from this base that it would inspire Malthus's theory on the subject, considering that every Bible in English would remind them of the signal achievements of their ancestors, in light of all this, a breach with England, when it came, could only be about much more than the price of tea. The New Englanders had an illustrated martyrology depicting the ghastly deaths of many men and women they revered as saints and heroes. Oddly, their interest in this enormous volume, which in an earlier version influenced Shakespeare, is treated as another of their creepily unwholesome obsessions. It is, in fact, a carefully documented history with relevant source materials in Latin and Greek and in translation, which might usefully be consulted to establish the idea content of Puritanism as it was once meant to justify and preserve it. Why did Edwards bring so much attention to these classic Puritan writers in A Treatise Concerning Religious Affections? In his preface, he alludes to a time when Satan prevailed against New England to quench the love and spoil the joy of her espousals about 100 years ago. This would be the Cromwell period, when the Commonwealth made England new, or when New England experienced a virtual independence from a government that was sympathetic in any case, or when it seemed that Puritan New and Old England, both the Englands, as one Cromwell period writer called them, would be, in effect, wed. The parliamentary government, therefore the revolution in England, collapsed in part because of sectarianism. Cromwell and his Congregationalists fought 2 major battles against the Presbyterians. He won, of course, being Cromwell, but in such circumstances there is only loss. Edwards can see the fissuring that is taking place already within the present revival, accusations and animosities over how conversion is prepared for and experienced, and how it should manifest itself in subsequent behavior. And then there are the skeptics, Bostonians and others, who are also Puritans, and who must be persuaded of the authenticity of these conversions, and more generally, must be made to accept that God is acting and bringing about this awakening. Edwards feels this revival to be of exceptional historical significance, as his allusions to early Christianity, the struggle with Rome, as well as his use of the language of actual warfare, make clear. So his intentions are, as he says, to address the question that most concerns both mankind as a whole and every individual person, the nature of true religion. Factionalism is for him both the degeneration of religion within the individual sensibility and the collective effect of this degeneration on groups of individuals, for example, in the tendency of people to conform their behavior to the behavior of those around them. He identifies no adversary except, glancingly, Satan. He will not pass judgment on the spiritual state of individuals, no matter what he thinks of their conduct. The covenant of grace leaves that mystery to God. Even one despairing over his own spiritual state must remember that life in the winter is hid in the root, in the words of Sibbes. This high Puritanism does not offer any final assurances. They did not believe in salvation by works, but they did believe that the effective will to lead a generous life was an indication that one was saved. In All Things for Good, Watson says, "The mercies of God work compassion to others. A Christian is a temporal savior. He feeds the hungry, clothes the naked. Charity drops from him freely as myrrh from the tree." Granting the impossibility of judgment in individual cases, including one's own, Edwards does believe hypocrisy, self-deception, and the influence of Satan are active in this and any revival, tending to destroy the revival and to discredit religion. The only response is to make each person an honest and competent judge of the integrity, the graciousness, of her own experience, of his own soul. I have no idea what the relation of the British authorities to the colonial press was when Edwards wrote. I know that in the 19th century, during the Chartist movement, which was the nearest Britain ever came to another civil war, a Stamp Act was used to put dissident publications out of circulation. An expensive stamp had to be affixed to each copy, so the readers to whom they were addressed could not afford to buy them. This seems more the sort of thing that would have offended the New Englanders than any mere tax on comestibles. A free press was characteristic of reformed societies, notably Geneva, the Netherlands, and England, during the reign of Edward VI and the protectorship of the Earl of Somerset. Edwards's allusion to the Commonwealth period, surely a touchy subject from an English point of view, is oblique. More generally, the question that comes to mind, reading the preface, is what is he trying to prepare his readers for? Cromwell's great military success was largely due to his attracting an army of, in his words, plain russet-coated fellows, ordinary, self-disciplined, reliable men who were unmoved by danger and hardship, godly men, in a term of the time, meaning Puritans in all their varieties. Edwards's ideal is clearly much closer to such figures than to the enthusiasts whom he sees as in love with themselves and their affections rather than with God. He justifies his criticisms, which he knows may be reproached in these captious, censorious times, by summoning the voices of the Puritan Golden Age. His hope is to poise the awakening on the knife edge of zealous restraint. He quotes Flavel, "The more rational any gracious person is, by so much more is he fixed and settled and satisfied in the grounds of religion. Yea, there is the highest and purest reason in religion, and when this change is wrought upon men, it is carried on in a rational way." Isaiah chapter 1 verse 18, John chapter 19 verse 9. The great inducement to what Edwards would consider a true and ideal frame of religion, and the great standard of having reached it as well, is aesthetic experience. Puritanism is commonly thought of as averse to beauty because they rejected iconography, ornamentation, and personal display. This is a consequence of their seeing elements of idolatry in the religious use of images, of reaction against the costliness of churches in a world much afflicted by poverty, and of rejection of the sumptuary laws that made social status apparent in dress. These were responses to popular criticisms current since the 14th century at least. Simultaneous with this outward austerity, if that is the right word, is a celebration of the intrinsic beauty that is the signature of God in creation. Shepherd says, "To find God, oh, pass by all the rivers till thou come to the spring head, wade through all creatures until thou art drowned, plunged, and swallowed up with God." It is crucial that the unmediated perception of the divine, that most glorious and most inward human privilege, is an aesthetic experience. Edwards says, "He that sees the beauty of holiness, or true moral good, sees the greatest and most important thing in the world, which is the fullness of all things, without which the world is empty, no better than nothing, yea, worse than nothing. Unless this is seen, nothing is seen that is worth the seeing, for there is no other true excellency or beauty. Unless this be understood, nothing is understood that is worthy of the noble faculty of understanding." And he says, "God is God, and distinguished from all other beings, and exalted above him, chiefly by his divine beauty, which is infinitely diverse from all other beauty. They therefore see the stamp of this glory in divine things, they see divinity in them, they see God in them, and so see him to be divine, because they see in them wherein the truest idea of divinity does consist. Thus a soul may have a kind of intuitive knowledge of the divinity of the things exhibited in the gospel. The argument is but one, and the evidence direct. The mind ascends to the truth of the gospel but by one step, and that is its divine glory." This experience gives the person who receives it a spiritual knowledge that primarily consists in a taste or relish of the amiableness and beauty of that which is truly good and holy. This holy relish is a thing that discerns and distinguishes between good and evil, between holy and unholy, without being at the trouble of a train of reasoning. It shapes the conduct of saints in the world. There is such a thing as a divine taste given and maintained by the Spirit of God in the hearts of the saints, whereby they are in like manner led and guided in discerning and distinguishing the true spiritual and holy beauty of actions, and that more easily, readily, and accurately, as they have more or less of the Spirit of God dwelling in them. Conduct so derived and guided will be sweet, humble, meek, and charitable. Edwards's purpose is to protect a tradition of Protestant inwardness that, on the strength of the exalted human capacity it recruits to a direct perception of this most sacred beauty, can claim to participate in essential cosmic reality. This is the definitive experience, over against which all other religious experience is exposed as false or feigned or misguided. It is based in a discipline of self-scrutiny that would shield it from every pressure, including the tendency toward enthusiasm and degeneracy Edwards sees around him. A striking difference between the kind of thinking about human nature and experience that one finds in Edwards and his tradition on the one hand, and modern thinking on the same subjects on the other, is that the older thought invites assent. Readers are implicitly invited to consult with themselves as to the persuasiveness of the description of the inward life that is offered to them. The forcefulness of the prose in these passages is meant to stir recognition. Is it possible to assent to the idea of a beauty that exceeds any conception we have of beauty? Is the moral and religious sense an aesthetic sense, as unmediated in its reactions as taste? The meaningfulness of the questions themselves would await affirmation by individual responses to them, and the differences of response would themselves be meaningful. That we live in and with our minds differently from one another is a given of Puritan theology. That we can experience our own minds differently from one moment to the next is also a given. In the understanding of Edwards's tradition, these things are true because the mind is an intimate relation to God, stirred by conscience, accepting or resisting grace. The Puritan scheme can be deeply sensitive to shadings, variable responses to the essential and immutable. In The Bruised Reed, Sibbes says, "We must acknowledge that in the covenant of grace, God requires the truth of grace, not any certain measure, and a spark of fire is fire, as well as the whole element. Therefore, we must look to grace in the spark as well as in the flame. All have not the like strong, though they have the like precious, faith." A glimpse of incomparable beauty has all the authority of a vision of it. In any case, we do indeed differ in the character of our experience, person to person and moment to moment. Our modern anthropologies have no language to account for complexity and mutability, nor for conscience or aesthetic sense as experience. If a theory of consciousness cannot address primary aspects of consciousness, it should not claim to have supplanted a more sufficient conceptual language, certainly not by treating the complexity that conceptual language reflects as if it were non-existent.